Before we start our lesson, I did forget one thing this morning. We do have Lenten devotionals from Presbyterians today. They're available in the narthex. The theme this year is a Lenten invitation to pray with art. The title is Awakening to God's Beauty, and you'll see that there's lots of great natural beauty photographed in here, and prayers for every day, marked by the day so that you don't get confused by the second Tuesday of Lent. You'll know when it's Friday, March 29th. So those are available in the narthex for you to pick up on your way out, and if you forget today, you can pick them up on Wednesday, and if you forget on Wednesday, they'll probably still be here, some here next Sunday. That gets us to the start of Matthew 17. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with them. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself. Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. If we expand this passage a little bit in both directions, a little bit before the start of it and a little bit after the end of it, we get that Jesus is telling the disciples that he is going to die. And that's kind of what brackets this encounter, is Jesus telling the disciples that he is going to die and that it's going to be painful, and both that they should not worry and that they should sort of be concerned. We know then, as we know now, that the disciples really don't get it. That's true about the disciples in AD 30, and it's true about the disciples in 2019. And one of the pieces that struck me in this passage is that Jesus is trying and trying and trying to tell them and us about what is coming. And I had this flashback because I was talking with one of you about VCRs this week. You know how hard it is to find a VCR these days? And when we would rent a video, you know, I'm showing my age here. You'd put the video in and you'd hit play and there'd be all those previews, right? And some of them, by the time you got the movie, could be really dated. If you were watching a movie that had come out several years ago, it wasn't like a preview of anything still coming. And that one came out 10 years ago. But supposed to whet our appetite, make us want to go rent or see the movie, make us want to get excited about what was coming. It's, you know, it's a preview of coming attractions. That even sounds positive, which is not kind of like, it's actually the exact opposite of what they do on drug commercials now with that little fast announcer voice at the end is a preview of not so wonderful attractions. The side effects may include. Jesus tells the disciples that he's going to die. Peter says, "No, no, you're not. Peter, come on." And then Jesus has the conversation with them about taking up their cross. And one of the things that we as 21st century Christians do is that we forget that they hadn't seen Jesus take his up yet. And we use it as a great discipleship. It's a devotional piece. It's a motivational poster piece. But we do that having read to the end of the book. The disciples there, this is kind of an odd thing for Jesus to say. "Well, Rabbi, why would we need to take up our cross and follow you?" That's kind of creepy, Lord. Even after Jesus has said, I'm going to die, they don't quite put those pieces together. You must take up your cross and follow me if you would be my disciple. Now, there's a lot involved in that. It's painful. It's criminal. It's not exactly the way you want to get your name in the newspaper. That's just the physical side of it. We read the narrative of Jesus at the cross, and we see betrayal, and we see loss, and we see abandonment. We see that the disciples who were so convicted this week, that week, are just going to go hide in the upper room. And so Jesus follows this up. He waits a week, and I hadn't really put together that there's a whole week of waiting in there. It's 6 days later that they go up on the mountain. Well, that's from first day to last. Ooh, there's all sorts of neat stuff going on there. And it's Peter and James and John and Jesus. They go up on top of the mountain, and Jesus suddenly is different. Like, maybe they're going to get it this time. And Elijah and Moses are there, and there's this, I don't know what you want to call it. Like, is it a heavenly board meeting, or is it the meeting with the two former pastors, and everybody's talking about I don't know what it is, but it's something special that's happening there. So special that Peter's like, well, we'll just stay right here. I'll build you a house, and you a house, and you a house. And I think in Peter's mind he's going, and we'll charge admission to have people come see you. And that's when the cloud comes and things get overshadowed, and there's the big voice that, if it wasn't clear before now, for at least Peter and James and John, it should be pretty clear now. This is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. That Jesus, who's talking with Elijah and Moses, is not really of this earth. It's not clear. Spoiler, it's not clear. Because they have to go back down the mountain. Jesus isn't done doing what Jesus is going to do. That's what's fascinating to me about the way that this comes together in Matthew, that is not typically the way we read this in church. We don't typically read that part about take up your cross and follow me on the same Sunday as Transfiguration. They're two separate events. Well, they're only 6 days apart. But we don't connect that that's really the start of that journey to Jerusalem for Jesus. The disciples get a very clear view of who Jesus is. Booming voice, bright lights, heavenly visitors. Like, it cannot get a whole lot more obvious. And then they're going to go make the trip that goes to Jerusalem and Golgotha. And Jesus is going to show them what it means to take up a cross and follow. I hate to tell you, but there's a lot of us who are with Peter, and we'd want to build the three houses on top of the mountain. I mean, it happens almost every time we go on a retreat or a mission trip. We're getting along so good. Things are going great. I have great insight into God. It feels like God is real close. Can't we just stay here? Well, Ameren still wants to be paid, and so we come back to the real world. And I say that piece about Ameren wanting to be paid because that's a huge piece of the real world, is money and economics. the realities of everyday life. We come back because Jesus realizes that for the rest of the world to get the experience that Peter, James, and John have on top of the mountain, the rest of the world has to see him. And the best way to do that, if you're Jewish, is to go to Jerusalem, let alone Jerusalem at Passover. That's when the whole world is supposed to gather anyway to celebrate this miraculous thing that God did once upon a time, a long time ago, that we're still sort of talking about then. Which might be kind of how a lot of us do Sunday church, is that we're still talking about that great thing God did a long time ago, but we need to be reminded and face-to-face with it in reality. The disciples don't get it. We don't get it. Jesus gets that his ministry is not to be proclaimed to the few, but to the many. So he's got to come back down here to the real world. Well, when he gets back down here to the real world, you guys have all read this story before. Who wants to see Jesus? Is it the Pharisees? Is it the Sadducees? Is it the Romans? Pilate is just waiting in line, right, to see Jesus. Who wants to see Jesus? When do you want Jesus the most in your life? What? Time of trouble, right? When we hurt. The poor, the hungry, the thirsty, the hurting. To borrow the phrase from this morning, the wretched and the worm. And that's who Jesus hangs out with. Jesus hangs out with kind of the disreputable folk of the world because they're the ones who want to be with Jesus. Everybody else is too busy. Too much money to be made, too much status to be had. Everybody else is busy doing other stuff. There's a parable about that we'll get into in Lent. This real world is the place that Jesus goes when he tells his disciples to follow him, to take up their cross and follow. This real world of people who need to be healed and people who need to be fed, corruption that needs to be cleansed. That's the real world Jesus goes back into that we remark upon in Lent, that we are afraid to remark upon the rest of the time. ...52% of American public school children are on free or reduced lunch. 52%. That's not because we as a nation are that poor. That's because the new version of segregation has people who can afford it putting their kids in private schools. I'm one of those private school kids. I'm allowed to make that comment. Mecklenburg County, where Charlotte, North Carolina sits, has an 80% overall public school on free or reduced lunch. Think about that. A city of 1.5 million and 80% of their public school kids are on free or reduced lunch. And before you think it's a city problem, at one point, Jefferson Elementary School in this town was at 74% on free or reduced lunch. Charlotte is also the site of much news lately, in that it is perhaps the only place in the country to ever have a federal election overturned due to voter fraud, with one of the most gerrymandered congressional districts in the history of the country. The 2018 district for the election was a result of a court case in 2016 that overturned the 2016 congressional districts, that overturned the 2012 congressional districts. At one point, one of the districts that ran through Charlotte was comprised of the eastbound lanes of I-85. If you ever want to know what gerrymandering looks like, go look it up. We say that corruption and power isn't still among us. The guy who's had his win overturned is an evangelical minister who refused to take the advice of his son, who is an assistant United States attorney on the matter. These things are still with us. It is not that Jesus goes down and there's no sick people anymore. 50% of bankruptcies in the United States are due to health care costs, health care bills. We have sick people among us, clearly. And we have poor people, and we have hungry people, and we have corruption. Knowing what we know about Jesus, how do we take that line that says, take up your cross and follow me? Because he goes right down into all of this messy stuff and lives with it and touches it and lets it touch him and really demands simply by his presence that it not be allowed to stay the same. Now, we know that Jesus did not fix all those problems because we're still dealing with them. But he didn't shy away from them either. And we have gotten really good at shying away from them. I think the challenge for us in Lent is if we see Jesus, really see Jesus, and if he really sees us, are we willing to take up a cross that is muddy and messed up, that is a sign of pain, a sign of criminality, and carry it with us every place that we're going to go? The Romans, there are really weird side effects of being a Bible scholar. One of them is you learn a lot about capital punishment by the Romans. They were very efficient. They would reuse crosses. Think about that for a moment. And we also know that they didn't like to do crucifixions very often because the crucifixion itself wasn't a great deterrent. It was leaving the corpse hanging there that was the great deterrent. So now think about what that means about hauling a used cross around when Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. Take up the cross that's already been punctured by nails, that's already had arms strapped to it, that has already been carried through town as a sign of shame, that already has blood and sin and pain and loss strapped to it, worn into it, stained. We're not going to give you a nice clean cross. That would defeat the purpose. This is a punishment. When we say, take up our cross and follow Jesus, do we just mean on Sunday morning, or do we mean the rest of the time? Do we mean into those messy places where we are totally aware of how much the cross weighs and how much it carries on it? you've ever had to carry something heavy, right? Kids these days, I'm too old for this. A lot of them in high school have to carry the fake baby around and wear it for the week or the month or whatever it is. Laurel, have you had to do that yet? Not yet. And that teaching tool is designed to remind them of the weight of life. I would argue that the image of us carrying our cross is designed to remind us of the weight of being a follower of Jesus, of being a resident in a world where sin is real and pervasive. And a reminder of what happens when that weight is lifted off of us. By the time we get to Good Friday, we're going to have done a lot of stuff. We're going to have heard of a lot of sermons. We're going to have heard a lot of music. What we tend to forget is that Jesus goes to the cross of his own volition. He takes it up. It is not put upon him. He takes it up. Are we willing to take it up? To choose again to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, to carry the weight of the world as it is, not the weight of the world as it should be. To God alone be the glory this day and forevermore. Amen.